Welcome to That Anthro Podcast, the podcast dedicated to anthropology. Together, each week, we will be learning from the experts and researchers that are researching our pasts and today's problems. My name is Gabriella Campbell, and I'll be interviewing a new guest each week to bring to you the latest and greatest in anthropology. Join me for weekly episodes, whether you're an anthropology buff or looking to learn something new. Welcome to That Anthro Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Everyone, welcome back to That Anthro Podcast. Today we have Tara with us. I'm so excited. She's a listener of the podcast, which is obviously as exciting. I mean, I'm happy to have any guest on, but I feel like it's different when it's someone who, you know, really is a fan and respects, you know, the work I'm doing. And I'm really excited to have you. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. And I'm excited to be here as well.
Yeah. So we were just talking before we hopped on recording about your move. You just moved. You're about to start your master's. Tell us a bit about where you moved to and what you're going to be doing your master's in.
Okay. So I moved from Cambridge to London because I recently just graduated from Cambridge. I did a degree in history of art and I've moved to London to do my master's in Mediterranean archaeology, which I'm very much looking forward to. So it's a year-long course and it's a very, very wide curriculum. So you could look at anything from like Egypt, you could go to Cyprus, like the Baltic Sea. It really has a lot of like scope geographically of what you want to do as well as time periods. But my interest is Anatolian archaeology. So that's Turkey / Syria. Kind of on that like Turkish Syrian border, but yeah, that's what I did.
So I'm in a 2-year master's program, and given how quickly paced a 2-year master's program in, my brain kind of hurts thinking about a 1-year. Do most people not collect their data in the field? Is that how they do it?
So there's no field work in this 1-year master's. So it's very much theoretical. And also because I did a history of art degree, I need that kind of like theoretical base before I can do a lot of like self-directed or co-directed field work. So at this point in my kind of like educational trajectory, the year's master's probably would fit me better than like a 2-year master's where I'd be doing more field work. So, yeah, that's why I kind of went for that. But also at UCL, they encourage you to kind of do your fieldwork like in the summer beforehand. So I recently came back from Greece. So that was the practical experience that I was encouraged to get alongside the master's. Yeah.
Awesome. That's great that they actually encourage that. I'm kind of currently in that phase of like, well, if I'm going to collect data in the field, I'm going to have to do it this next summer. And there are just a lot of factors that I wouldn't say, I'm not saying like, I'm not going to just like, it's going to be a lot of planning. And so I'm kind of moving towards being like, it might just be easier to not do field work for that. And then maybe try to find like some sort of project that I could be like a supervisor or like a teacher at a field school, like after my master's. I like field work, but I'm also not like in love with it to the point where I'm going to be heartbroken I don't get to go dig in the dirt. Like, you know,
do you know what? It's quite nice to hear people say that because I like material culture and I like studying things that have already been found. So I'm a complete like museum enthusiast. So, you know, as much as I love getting my hands dirty and I absolutely loved being in Greece on the dig, I thought it was the most fantastic experience. My interest is kind of sitting down with that object that's just been found and really, really looking at it and studying it and like kind of comparing it to primary like sources and books and papers and, you know, so that's kind of my relationship with fieldwork, which sounds similar to yours as
Yeah.
well, maybe.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think it's great to do. I've done a field school. I've done some other I guess I've really just done a field school. But my brain's like, what else have we done? But yeah, I think it's great to have the experience, but then not necessarily, it's not everything you have to do.
I originally was looking for like a field school or an excavation in Turkey, because that's the kind of direction that I see my career going in. That's where I want to get the experience. I probably know a lot more about Anatolian archaeology than I do like Greek, right? I mean, the two are very connected, but again, there's a lot of like there's so much diversity between them, and it's very difficult to like transfer your skills because you know they're nuanced. So I was looking for work in Turkey. It's really difficult to get on an excavation in Turkey at the moment. It's quite political. I won't go into it too much, but pretty much I think your best bet is being your best bet as someone that doesn't have a Turkish passport, trying to get on a Turkish excavation is being at a Turkish university. So you need to kind of know the supervisors, you need to know the lecturers that are gonna, you know, introduce you to these field schools. So I said, okay, I'm not gonna pay myself. I will option, you know, it's close. It's I know I just spoke about the differences, but there are some similarities. So I looked on the Hellenistic Educational Research Institute in Peloponnese, and they had two schools working. They did the ancient Sparta and ancient Mycene, and I applied and I got on it. I was really, really happy. It was only 2 weeks, which is actually very short, I think. But yeah, so I ended up getting on the ancient Mycene dig, which I was very happy about. But yeah, and then I went in July. It was absolutely fantastic, like the best. Yeah, really, really great.
In kind of geographically in Greece, specifically north, south, coastal, inland.
So it's near Kalamata, so it's coastal. We're looking in like the Peloponnesian region,
Got it.
which I think is south, but we were like an hour away from Kalamata in a taxi, but in this really tiny little village, which was actually like the professor that we were working under. It was such a like community feel. He managed to get everyone in the community involved some way in this excavation, and like you know kind of created this really fantastic economy off of it as well, which I just thought was so fantastic.
You kind of told me that it's an acropolis and you were working in trenches. So specifically, A, I don't think we've ever talked about this, like what the process of digging a trench is. It's not the most exciting thing, but for anyone that doesn't know, we can kind of just like go basics of like what you were doing there.
Yeah, of course, definitely. So we were working in the agora of the Acropolis, which is kind of like the could you call it a marketplace? They kept calling it a marketplace, like an ancient marketplace. I think it was very kind of varied, but like if we're going to put it in modern terms, that would make a lot of sense, especially for what we found as well, which I'll get onto later, which was really exciting. But so we were working in three trenches, trench A, B, and C. I think it's quite funny when you have multiple trenches, it fosters a lot of competition between the people that are working in the different trenches. I don't know if you've experienced that. People get so competitive.
That's funny. No, because I've only excavated graves and there was like three of us working, well, three to four of us each working on one grave. But no, I can imagine.
It's just, it really does. It gets very competitive. So before we got there, they marked out the trenches and where we were going to be digging. And first we had to do contact sheets. So we had to kind of note down anything that was already in the like demarcated trench. A lot of it was in Greek as well, so we had to brush up on that. Very difficult, but good, a good skill. So we had to do our contact sheets every single morning. So pretty much like for listeners, if they haven't done this kind of thing before. When you're digging in a trench, every time you reach a new context, it means every time you reach a different kind of earth, or perhaps a new layer you find, or you find a particular object that's still in the ground that you really need to you need to note down, because it could mean that it had a different function to the layer before. So, for example, we had a very kind of like dusty, dry earth on the top. And when we went down a little bit, like a couple of inches, it started to be a bit more of a kind of a moister, darker earth. So we had to do a new context. So to kind of like open up our trench, we really went ham with a pickaxe, which I think sends chills down my spine, because I could see like pottery just being broken left, right, and center. But yeah, I know.
It's also a workout because they're heavy.
Oh my gosh, it really is. And like, you feel like you've been to the gym after, because you have these like calluses on your hands and your arms ache. And yeah, so we really went in with the pickaxe, first of all, to just get that first layer off. And then you start to reach a different context, and also things that you probably don't want to break. So we started to reach a bit more marble as well, where there were walls. We started to find pottery, which was in tacked as well, because on the top layer, a lot of it had already been kind of broken by the machines, like the JCBs that they had to get in beforehand to even like reveal the trench. So when we kind of reached this second layer, that's when we started going in with brushes and trowels. And I think a lot of the work at that point is really defining what you can already see there. So, you know,
it's called profiling.
Yeah, exactly. So for example, we had a wall that was running like horizontally through our trench. And it's crazy because we had no idea before we got like, I don't know, 4 inches beneath the ground. And they were like, oh, wow, it's a wall. That's incredible. So a lot of the time it was hands and knees, picking out the pottery, putting it in separate bags. That's another important thing. Always putting the pottery in a bag that corresponds to the right trench, otherwise you've got a big old mess. We had a lot of work going on inside the trenches, but also we had cleaning pottery on the side, which was hot. Actually, I forgot to mention how hot this all was. It was absolutely boiling. It was probably like high 30s, like degrees Celsius, right? I'm not sure what that is in Fahrenheit.
But it's between 90 and 100, which is very hot. And I did my field school in Spain during July too. So girl, I feel on a spiritual level.
It really, I got a lovely tan, but my gosh, it was absolutely boiling. But once again, shouldn't complain. It felt like a holiday at times, which was really nice. But yeah, so it was so hot there. But we would also kind of have breaks from digging the trench where we would go and do the pottery, clean it. It was so exciting, like seeing what, you know, once you scrape away that mud, what you find underneath. We found a coin. We're still not sure what age it is because they haven't. I know. I can see your face. You can't see mine, but I can see yours. And I know it was so exciting. We think so. The Professor Petros Themelis, he's been running the ancient Mycenaean site for like 40, 50 years. So he really loves and knows it inside and out. And he came down to see it, like, because it was a special occasion, kind of, you know, we found a coin.
Yeah, no, that's a big deal.
It really is. Yeah, it really, really is a big deal. It's not every day that you find a coin.
No, I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions of archaeology fieldwork is people really just think that we're pulling gold and coins and all this stuff out of the ground. First of all, you have to remember that there were centuries of looters that, if they knew where a site was, would loot a site. And, you know, especially when you're digging a trench, you didn't even know there's a wall there. The probability that you would find a coin is so low. So it's incredibly cool that you did find one.
Yeah, we found, I'll tell you some of the things that we found just, you know, while we're on the topic. So we found a coin. We found a an olive press, like a marble olive press that was completely intact. That was probably one of the most fantastic things. Yeah. And it even had the dip in the side of the press where the oil would run out. It was amazing. We didn't remove the whole thing because we weren't there long enough, but we saw the top. We also found two glass beads that were like perfectly, perfectly rendered. We found loom weights as well, which we think were used like in the marketplace, like people weaving. Also, it could have been like a domestic, you like to think of a kind of domestic business or a family business that take it to the market. And so, yeah, we found coins, glass beads, loom weights. Age period, I'm thinking classical as well. They had found like Iron Age finds in the same site before, but not in that particular trench. But most of the stuff that we found was classical, and then also leading up to Byzantine too. So, yeah,
I'm actually
really just.
surprised they even found Iron Age artifacts prior to that, because I know specifically in Greece, the transition, there was like literally the Dark Ages, where like across the whole freaking country there's hardly anything found, and the Iron Age only came right after that. It, at least I think I'm correct. If anyone's listening and I'm wrong, I'm sorry. It's been a while since I've taken a classics class, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. So that's really interesting. And well, and like you're saying, trenches typically, and I could be wrong, trenches are typically almost like a survey sort of thing. So it's almost like you're really going in with no idea what you're going to find, which is very different than for example, like a plot that's already been started, like a full area that's already been being peeled back layer by layer.
I mean, oh gosh. So we did have one day. There were so many different like exciting things that happened. I don't even know where to start, but there was this one day where we were so we'd done the pickaxe and we were going in with the trowels, and the ground beneath us in our trench started to feel very, very hollow. So everything that we would kind of knock on, it was reverberating. And we called down our like one of the trench supervisors, what was her name? Androniki, she was such a lovely lady. And she was kind of on the edge of thinking it might be a burial,
I
and
was
we all
about to say.
freaked out. We absolutely freaked out. And also, what was making it sound hollow, I have to, spoiler, it actually wasn't. It was really sad. It wasn't a burial. It was something completely different. But what had happened is a load of roof tiles had collapsed into the same spot on top of each other. And there was an ancient Mycenaean burial practice in which children were buried underneath tiles. So they were buried and then tiles were layered on top of them. So we were at this stage where we couldn't quite decide whether it was a child's burial, which would just be so interesting. It'd be, beyond this earth to find something like that. Or, is this a poorly built house that's just completely collapsed? Unfortunately, it was the latter, but it's at that kind of point where, you really don't know what to expect in a trench, as you were saying. It's completely unexpected, and it was really, really exciting. And I think at that point, I was like, oh wow, I love this so much. I love archaeology so much. But also, what you were saying about like the Dark Ages and the Iron Ages, I'm not quite sure in terms of like Greece, but one of the things that I'm most interested in is the Bronze Age and like what the hell happened between like kind of like in the second millennium, right? What happened? Because they are known as the Dark Ages, and one of my favorite books I've ever read was the it's called the Luwians, and it's The Missing Link of the Aegean Bronze Age. And the I don't want to go off on a tangent
No,
without
it's
kind
fine. We love books.
of
We love books on the podcast. I'm always here
okay,
for book recommendations.
fantastic. So pretty much the Luwians were allegedly, this is very hypothetical by the way, and the book is under quite a lot of criticism by academics, but the Luwians were allegedly a kind of collection of small to medium-sized like petty states or kingdoms in southwestern Anatolia, so like southwestern Turkey. Geographically, you're looking at kind of like bordering, not bordering, sorry, like opposite roads, so very close to Greece. And this kind of individual Luwian state or polity didn't identify as Greek and also didn't identify as like Hittite, which is your Anatolian civilization, mm-hmm. the, you know, the kind of most well-known one.
Yeah.
And your Luwian territory was also where the Battle of Troy happened. Mm-hmm. And it's also mentioned a lot in reference to the Sea Peoples. And I don't know if you've heard about the Sea Peoples.
I do, yes. Yeah. That's actually one of the leading theories about the Bronze Age collapse.
Yes, yeah, exactly. So this book was kind of trying to suggest that it was the Luwians that kind of formed this like confederation of the Sea Peoples, went to Egypt, left southwestern Turkey, left it open to attack from the Mycenaeans. They came in, like completely destroyed and restructured the place. And that's what happened in this like dark age. And also the book suggests that a lot of like Greek archaeology happened when the Ottoman Empire was in decline, and there was a lot of like prejudice, racism against Turkish people, in which those histories weren't as popular as Greek histories. So in scholarship, there's also a lack of Anatolian archaeology.
There's a I mean, lack it's got of better. Middle Eastern archaeology.
Oh yeah,
point blank. Period.
Completely. Completely. I mean, like Greek archaeology, obviously, and Cambridge is so bad for this as well. It's just like plumped center in any curriculum, like because they have a lot of the collection in the Fitzwilliam and also in the Museum of Classical Archaeology. But yeah, this Luwian civilization is apparently the kind of missing link of what on earth happened. Yeah. So if you're interested, definitely have a look at that.
Well, and when you say too, like it's under critique, I mean, I really kind of think any good scientific book article is going to go under critique because, you know, that's how theories are solidified and formed is you have some data and you present it and then you get the feedback and you work with, I mean, not everyone's going to like actually respond to the feedback, but you know, if you're a good researcher, well, then you take the data that other people have found and you try to find, you know, the common ground or any holes in your theory so that it is a stronger theory. So when you say that, I think as long as there's some form of evidence, as long as it's not some person who's like literally never has no relation, I think that's what you want.
Yeah, completely, completely. And I think the way this book was also presented was very unique to me. It was kind of in a holistic way in which they would, so the author is, what's his name? I've had the book, hang on. Eberhard Zanger, he's a German natural scientist. And I think he just became very, very interested in this like missing link and just went ham on it. But what he did in his book is he kind of presented each chapter in three sections, and it was current state of knowledge, hypothesis, and then he would save the last section with kind of like quotes from other scholars that would either support or challenge his theories to like give the reader the opportunity to like really kind of critique him. So it was a very confident way of like writing a theory. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was a great book. I'd recommend it to anyone. But
very unique style.
It was really, really unique. It was very sciencey, I thought.
Yeah.
I could see that he was a scientist from that. Like, because I think I don't know as much about in archaeology because obviously I'm coming from an art history basis, but in art history, people really love to like gatekeep their theories. And if they sense that someone might have something that like pulls the carpet from beneath them, it's scary.
Yeah. Well, they pretend like that opinion doesn't exist. And it's so sad too, because it's like literally if you just listen and you adapt your theory to become more, let's say, factually accurate. And by factual, you know, we're talking about the past. I don't mean factual in that's exactly what happened. I mean factual as in supported by some form of data.
It definitely, but so that was just a something that I thought I'd say on the point of kind of the like Bronze Age, Iron Age. What's your favorite time period?
Ooh, that's a good question.
It is. It's a difficult one. It's one that I've been grappling with for a while as well. To think my heart says one thing and then my mind says another thing, and then I'm like, what should I do?
I'm blanking on what the area is called, but between the Tigris and the Euphrates River, what is that called? Mesopotamia. Jeez, there we go.
Oh, nice.
I think Mesopotamia in general is really cool because of how revolutionary everything was that they were doing there. And
Yeah, like
how they
writing.
used the environment to their benefit, like between those two rivers. You know, people, you know, say all you want. That wasn't a coincidence. You know, people had traveled. I mean, even if we just think right back, like, let's say 5,000 years, people were migrating across the whole globe. And that means that there was some selection in where they actually started to develop more more advanced techniques, building, farming, etc. And I want to say some domesticated agricultural product came out of there. I'm not going to say which one because I really don't remember. And it's just so cool that, you know, using such a fertile valley and producing
definitely.
Such interesting things. But I also don't have a favorite because I really see myself as a global archaeologist.
I love that.
You know, I love it too, but some people really don't like that. They're like, oh, you're just interested in too many things. And I'm like, I think there's a time and a place. You know, some people have niches. My niche just happens to be more things. That's actually why I want to work in museums, is because
Me
I
too.
Think that for me, that's the best way to be able to continue my knowledge of global archaeology, but also be able to work on a lot of things and not feel limited to a niche.
And I think I love that. And I agree with a lot of the things that you just said. And I think that working in a museum, as someone who would like consider themselves as a global archaeologist, or even to like boil it down, like with Mediterranean archaeology, right? If I wanted to kind of translate that into a museum setting, you've got all of these different artifacts from all over the world. You need to find a way as a curator of synthesizing them into one show. How are you going to do that? How are you going to find the links? That to me is like the best challenge.
Same.
And I think, I think that's just that's the way of doing it as well, because you can still have a niche and you can still like, you know, like study these very specific like ingots or this very specific tablet or something like that. But if you can connect it to trade and migration and, you know, the translation of ideas and language, and it just makes it so much better, and it makes it more real as well, I think.
Yeah, and for me too, I'm really interested in curating a space that moves well, as in you can walk in and it's very you move through it in a sensible way. I think some museums and this isn't a critique, more as a we can do better. Certain museums, you know, even the Smithsonian Natural History Museum, please no one to come attack me, because I would like to work there, but I would like to help improve things. I just don't think the flow was great. Like, there was a couple places that bottlenecked at some of the most important information. And when it's a giant museum like that, it's like, you know, the information's still great, but we need to make a more open space for this specific, let's say, artifact that's everyone's going to look at. You know, we want to make sure the Venus of Willendorf is in a place where there's not going to be a bottleneck being able to see it.
Yeah, definitely. Do you know what, as well? It's I think it's the study of phenomenology. I found it so fascinating. So it's the human kind of interaction with a museum space, and how that affects, phenomenology.
Look it up,
please do. It's like, it's a tiny little branch of studies, but it's really popular in museum studies as well. So it looks at how people interact with the space and how that affects their interpretation of the object. And I don't think until you're in the kind of like, unless you're obviously like you're interested in that kind of curation mindset, it's not something that you think is important until you realize it is. And that's why people get, you know, I was about to say paid so much to be a curator, but that's a lie.
We don't need to
say that,
confuse the children.
Yeah, that's a lie. Like, if you want to be a curator, you better love it.
If you want to do anything in anthropology, you better love it.
Oh, crikey, you really better.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's why it's such a kind of time-consuming role, because mm-hmm. you're really, in a way, you're manipulating how the public view history.
Yeah.
And that's a burden, but that's mm-hmm. also a privilege. And you've got to have very I think you've got to be very kind of open to the like diversity of the public that you're gonna attract. Mm-hmm. I think more and more like recently we've been seeing kind of museums trying to reflect their diverse audience, or trying to tell new stories mm-hmm. and find different, like, even I know a lot of the work in the Museum of Classical Archaeology in Cambridge, they're doing on like queer histories in ancient Greece. I know, it's really great.
Love it.
It's so great. So they did this like trail through the museum, which still has the original labels, but then it has like an alternative label, which like tells another story about it, which you probably wouldn't see otherwise. I thought that was fantastic. It was really good.
It is.
And I was so happy. I was like, thank God people are doing stuff like this.
Yeah. If you haven't already listened, and you might have, and if you haven't, I'm not like judging. Sophie Price and Maddie McAllister's episodes on this podcast, you have to listen mm-hmm. to, because they curate at the Tropical Museum of Queensland, and they've Ooh. Been doing a lot of work to have Indigenous voices mm-hmm. in the actual exhibits, as in like the plaques. You know, they have an actual like written up thing by someone who's Indigenous to the artifact that it's Indigenous to the culture in which the artifact is from. Excuse me. Telling that side of the story, as well as the more like where it was found, any sort of archaeological background that goes with it. And I thought that that reminds me of what you're saying of, you know,
definitely.
It doesn't have to be one or the other. Everything can exist in tandem.
Exactly.
Hell, like, we can make museum placards a little bigger. You know, they don't need to mm-hmm. be tiny. Like, not everyone's going to read them still, but it does enhance mm-hmm. the experience of the people that do read them. And I've spent so much time in so many different museums around the globe. And, you know, actually one of my favorites is the Archaeological Museum in Greece in Athens.
Ooh. Oh, I've never been. I've never been to Athens either.
I would say Athens as a whole, I wasn't like over the moon with, but the archaeology is unparalleled. So it was definitely cool to go there.
Was it the artifacts in the museum or the museum space that made you like it the most?
A bit of both. Mm-hmm. For example, so it's directly next to the Acropolis. You can see the Acropolis from the museum, and they have it laid out in, I don't think all of it. I'm trying to remember. At least one section is laid out in how it would have been on the Acropolis. So the reliefs.
Oh, wow.
The reliefs that used to line the top of the Parthenon, my poor brain is like, is that right?
I was like is it?
Yeah, the reliefs that lined the top of the Parthenon that had all these different scenes mm-hmm. are in the order around a rectangle that's the size of the Parthenon. So when you walk around, it's like you're getting somewhat of an experience of like it would have been to see it.
That's fantastic. I'm such a big believer in like digital reconstruction. I know that's obviously not, that's physical, uh-huh. but like physical or digital reconstructions of things that help people. I mean, there's a there's an altar. There's like an altar piece that was used in an oxen based ritual or something mm-hmm. like that. I'm not quite sure. It's a little bit later than the stuff that I look at, but the display of it is absolutely fantastic. So they've got this like altar piece. Just kind of like on the floor on a stand, and then behind it they've got a wall, but on the wall they have invited a local artist to paint the scene of that altarpiece in its original function, so you can actually see like what it would have been used for and what it would have looked like when and also, oh gosh, one of the most fantastic things about this like artifact is that if you look inside you can still see evidence of like fire. So you can see where it's been tarnished on the side of the... Yeah, it's so fantastic. Just those little, like, details get you. But, yeah, digital reconstructions, physical reconstructions, through artwork, through, like, play, theatre, anything like that, I think can really open up a museum space a lot.
It
I love it.
definitely can. You mentioned, and feel free if you don't want to answer this, you're under no obligation to. You mentioned when we go to Turkey, are you Turkish?
I'm not Turkish, actually. No, I'm half Indian. So my dad is Punjabi, and my mom's just like British. But we, so my grandparents used to work abroad a lot. They worked in like Egypt, Tunisia, and then they worked in Turkey for about a year, and they absolutely fell in love with it, and they ended up retiring there. And
Nice.
this was, yeah, so this was when I was probably like two or three, and since then, every single summer, like we will just go out to Turkey and stay there. And it's a very, it's not a small town that we go to, but it's kind of like a quieter, it's not as rich as Istanbul. And I don't know if you've ever been to Turkey or.
I haven't, but my old roommate was Turkish, and she,
Ah.
has, lovely stories of visiting her family there.
It's just Turkey is just my favorite country in the world. I think it's beautiful. It's the most beautiful place I've ever been. It's so rich, so you can literally feel like you're in like I don't know. So you go from being kind of in the heart of the Ottoman Empire because you're in Istanbul and you're surrounded by all of these mosques and the palaces, and then you go down to the coast and you're in ancient Lycia, and you've got the like Xanthos and Patara and the amphitheaters, and so there's such a big range of history in Turkey. But yeah, so we have our house pretty much like in the center of ancient Telemessos, which was a part of like the Lycian League, and like in kind of like I don't know, like the 5th century BCE, probably until like the Romans invaded. But yeah, so I kind of like grew up around that history and just became absolutely fascinated by it. Yeah, so
That's
that's
awesome.
where it comes from. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Kind of switching gears, but it's been on my mind since you mentioned ingots the other it was like quite a while back, and I think you were mentioning it completely off topic, but it got me thinking about something you told me, which is that you might either you are working or you might get to work on the I'm gonna say it wrong, Uluburun shipwreck.
Oh, so gosh, I would love to say that I could like work on it, like work near it. I think it would probably be on an artifact that was found in it.
Oh, that's what I figured. When I was
Oh
working on
gosh.
it, I think they've excavated that whole thing by now.
They really have. Yeah, they have. I think they found everything they could possibly find. But actually, never say never. But yeah, so I'm kind of in two minds at the moment because I had this like I don't know if you have the same experience, but every day I'll have like a new thesis title that will just like come to me in a dream, or like I'll be sitting there like eating a sandwich. I'm
Honestly,
like,
I
oh my
wish.
God, I'm gonna write my dissertation about this. Or so I still need to I need to actually enroll in my course first. But so I really wanted to look at a particular pendant. It's called the Astarte pendant, which was found. Well, so there was a particular one that was found in the Uluburun shipwreck, and it was from Israel. I can't remember what site. I should remember that. It's really bad. But it's now at the British Museum. And this particular pendant, similar ones have been found like all over the Mediterranean in different sites. They're usually from the Bronze Age. They supposedly represent the Canaanite goddess of fertility. But what I would like to look at is how these symbols on these pendants have changed throughout the like geographic region, and what this could mean to the different cultures that are interacting with them every day. And also, in a lot of these pendants, we know they were worn, so we also know that they traveled with people. So I also wanted to look at the way in which we can connect, we can kind of discover trade routes through looking at material culture and finding visual similarities.
Very
So
cool.
thank you. And that is one idea. But the Uluburun shipwreck, and then there's another one. It's in Cape Gelidonia, both in Turkey. But I think you would be really, really interested in these as like a global archaeologist, because
Yeah.
it's especially the Ulibrin shipwreck, it's probably one of the most significant examples of how extensive trade was throughout the Mediterranean in the Bronze Age, because they found this shipwreck, which was in southwestern Turkey. They found on it like a gold scarab with like the name of Nefertiti inscribed in it. They found jars from Israel. They found like black wood from Africa. They found hippo tusks, elephant tusks carved into ivory, like different kind of like ivory, jars and what's it called? Like goblets, like you know what they drink out of. They found pottery from Cyprus. They found beads from like the Baltic Sea. They found an axe that they thought was from Bulgaria as well. So, yeah. So this one boat has either been to different places that have really good trade connections or has itself traveled to all of these different places in its journey. And I think, you know, take us back like 50 years. A lot of archaeologists think that, or kind of thought that nation states or like Bronze Age nation states existed in very isolated circumstances and didn't have a lot of interaction, right? And I think you still get archaeologists that really want to push that narrative today. But shipwrecks like this, case studies like this prove that that is just so wrong. And people met and people shared languages, and it really wasn't that dissimilar today. It was just a lot slower because it had to be. But
Yeah, it was a lot slower. I think one
was a
of the
lot,
other big discoveries on that ship, and I could be mixing it up with another shipwreck, is that there was a ton of what the stuff that makes bronze, which copper,
copper alloy, like a copper
yeah,
kind of.
copper alloy and
Yes.
tin, there we go, and
Yes,
tin.
yes,
There was a
yes.
ton of it on the ship, which was so unique because certain places in Europe, I believe it was tin that was the hard thing to come by in Europe. There were only certain natural places where it was
Yes,
occurring, and so to make
exactly.
all of the bronze that they were using for weapons and for jewelry, they needed to get it from other places, or at least one of the ingredients to make bronze, because bronze is not just naturally occurring, it's an alloy.
Alloy,
So
yeah.
I think that was a big discovery on that shipwreck too.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And it also shows that people had these like established networks that would really contribute to their entire economy. So for example, I should know this, but I'm not quite sure. You're definitely right, but I'm not sure where like the tin was coming from. Or where, well, actually, I think the boat was actually going to like a Mycenaean palace. And the theories are that it was either coming from Cyprus or like this kind of like Syro, like Palestinian area. But that's still kind of on the ropes. They're not quite sure. But it shows that like people relied on, also kind of like civilizations relied on other civilizations to boost their economy. And it's, you know, the exact same today. We do the exact same. If there's poor relations between two countries, like for example, in England right now, our energy crisis, like we have an energy crisis. And the same thing would most likely have happened back in the day if civilizations were in political turmoil or they were going through war. These different like nautical kind of like pathways would be cut off. And you wouldn't be able to trade with these countries anymore. So, you know, I'd say individual city states and individual civilizations weren't overly self-reliant. They definitely relied on these cultures outside of them, which I think is wonderful.
I think you and I could talk for ages about this stuff.
Yeah, definitely. I know. I get the sense. I really do. But yeah.
I have a specific question for you, and it's kind of something that I've started in this new season. I think we all need to, be proud of our accomplishments. So I'm curious, what is a project or an instance or an event that from your time in undergrad at Cambridge that you're really proud of?
I think definitely is getting published.
Woo,
So
round of applause.
thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Yeah, I just didn't. I think I kind of had heard so many people, because obviously in like academia, you have it's not easy to get published, but I think it's, you know, if you want to kind of go into like a magazine or something like that, it's a lot easier than trying to get into like an academic journal because people are so rigorous. And I've had the like the green light, but I'm still going through editing processes now, and the launch event is in November, so like I that it's probably going to be even more leading up to that. But I am being published in a peer-reviewed journal. It's the Archaeological Review from Cambridge, and it's a biannual journal. Some people that have been like that have published in the journal before, Ian Hodder, I don't know if you know Ian Hodder. He's like a
Think so.
processual archaeologist of the 1960s and 70s, and he kind of like pioneered the field. And it was a real like pinch me moment because I was actually doing my reading for the paper that I was writing, and I referenced him, and then I looked him up and I saw that he had like had his first paper published in the exact same journal that I was being published in. And
That's
I
so
was like,
cool.
you are kidding me. And it was very exciting. But so the paper that I've written, and it's been a long process. I literally submitted my proposal last November, and I'm still editing it. But the title of the paper is called Seeing Through an Imperial Lens: The Aesthetics of Photography in Ernst Krickel's 1892 Lycian Journal. And I'll break that down a little bit. So, in 1892, there was an expedition that was led by an Austrian archaeologist called Otto Bendorf, and he went to Lycia, which is in southwestern Turkey. And it was around the same time that the Harpy Monument and the Nereid Monument was shipped to the British Museum by Charles Fellowes. So like big kind of European imperial rivalry going on at the time. Who could find the best artifact? Who could, you know, bring something home that their country would be proud of? There was a lot of imperial kind of like bolstering and encouragement at that time. And I came across a book that was published about this specific photo journal that one of the team members of the 1892 expedition had created during his time there. And it started off with just pictures from like the port in Trieste. It's where they left in Austria to go on their expedition. And then it went all through Turkey. And then it went like back through Greece, and it's almost like a travel journal. And at the start, I thought, okay, this is cool. Like, this is just nice to see someone else's journey. And then I looked deeper into the images, and what I found is that a lot of the images were just of kind of like landscapes, but there was a couple which were the Austrian team positioned next to the like archaeological artifacts or monuments that they had quote unquote found in Lycia. And alongside these pictures of the Austrian archaeologists with the artifacts, there were also images of the Ottoman, because the Turkey was Ottoman Empire at the time, of Ottoman locals with the same artifacts. And the tones in these two separate images were so different that it was very obvious that the photographer had tried to construct a this kind of like image of the like Austrian explorer with this like grand kind of like imperial image. And then on the other side, you had the way in which he represented the Ottoman locals. It was very much in a like orientalizing manner, in which they weren't ever named. They weren't ever presented as academics. Their only role as presented in this journal was as either a laborer, so like like a quote unquote unskilled worker. And actually in the journal it said servant. It referred to them as servants quite a lot. Or it was someone who existed alongside the artifacts or the ruins, but had no real knowledge of what was going on. So that was the image that was constructed through the photography and the captions of the journal. And with a lot of the, I still think archaeologists do this to themselves today, but you had images in which the Austrians had their like one foot upon like a Miletus lion, or they were standing at the top looking out to see as if, you know, they're about to embark on some miraculous adventure, when in reality, a lot of these objects had already been documented by the Ottoman authorities and were already in Ottoman like collections or museums. Yeah. So
they were literally just stealing them.
Yeah, exactly. They really, really were. And the more I kind of delved into why these kind of images would have been created, the more evident it became that the photography was actually a tool of imperialism, and specifically in relation to archaeology. Because I think also archaeology in the 18th and 19th century was a symbol of European power and superiority, especially over places like the Ottoman Empire, because you had countries such as, you had Germany, you had Austria, you had Britain, France, fighting over the right to own these objects. It still happens today.
Yeah.
You know, it's not something that's isolated to the past, but my paper's really looking into how these ideologies are represented through photography, and how photography really is a medium in which people can manipulate the way you see history. And that's the crux of it. But it's a very specific case study, but I hope it's something that can be kind of applied to other things as well. So
my mind's blown, because it's almost like a tool of propaganda.
Exactly. It really, really was. It really was a tool of propaganda. And it was interesting as well, because this journal wouldn't have been published in the way in which, you know, we can like we post something on Instagram that we see today and like thousands of people see it. It was quite a personal object, and it actually said who the journal was shared with at the end of the journal. And it was the ministry. It was officials from the Ministry of Culture in Austria. It was Otto Bendorf, and it was the family and friends of the photographer Ernst Krickel. And first of all, I thought, okay, like, should I read too much into the kind of like propagandistic qualities of this if it's only has a small reach? But then again, if you're dealing with very elite circles, those are the kind of people that are expecting and trying to like propagate these imperialistic ideologies in the first place. So actually, it really made sense to kind of pull these narratives out of something that probably would have been overlooked otherwise. So that was definitely like 100% my proudest moment, because I think it's feeling like someone actually cares about what you're researching is really bloody lovely.
It is.
And it really, really is. Yeah. Because a lot of the time, like, I think archaeology, you know, we're a rare breed sometimes. So it's nice to, get it
out
there.
And it's important to do projects like that reconcile the past of archaeology and the wrongdoings. You know, we can't just turn a blind eye and be like, oh, these things didn't happen. The locals weren't treated horribly. And although I don't really know much about the Ottoman Empire, like, regardless of whether they were quote unquote, what's a good way that I want to phrase it? You know, regardless of the Ottoman Empire, their you know, let's say their nationalistic intentions, those are their artifacts from their country, and the people digging them up probably had a very direct, if not slightly removed, connection to the people's cultures in which they're digging up, because that's indigenous archaeology. Happens definitely all over the world.
It really, really does. It really does. It's a global thing. And I think as well, what it made me realize is that it's quite easy to not kind of recognize these very subconscious biases that sometimes we ourselves, we can be, you know, we're not, you know, at fault most of the time, because I think it happens very naturally, and sometimes it's hard to escape the way you've been taught or your surroundings. But
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I think it's good to like study these things and try and analyze. I don't know if I should even bring this up, and feel free to edit this out. Mm-hmm. But I'd actually just like to ask you,
yeah,
and like completely feel free to edit this out. Mm-hmm. But it really made me think of, do you know who what's her name? Colleen Darnell is. She's a vintage Egyptologist, is her Instagram handle. And she's, do you know who I'm talking about?
I think I follow her.
Okay. I find her so fascinating, right? And one part of me is like, wow, she is the most fashionable lady I've ever seen in my life. She's amazing. Okay. So I do, on one side, I really, really like her. But then when I wrote this paper, I started thinking, I was like, okay, a large part of her aesthetic is colonial. It's massively, massively colonial.
Yeah,
and I thought, okay, is that, it's not, I don't feel like it's directly harming anybody, but mm-hmm. I feel there's something weird about it. There's just something really, really off about that.
So that's actually something that I've talked about on the podcast before with my good friend Katie Ibsen. She likes to say, and I don't know Colleen's view. I do follow Colleen on Instagram. When you said that, I was like, that's ringing bells. Mm-hmm. Vintage fashion, not values. And it's something that Katie is a big promoter of. Well, she's definitely not to the extent in her vintage fashion as this person that we're discussing. But she says that it's very important to her to separate the two. And so I think, you know, from that example, I think that there is in certain communities, not all, you know, there is quite a bit of discussion of vintage fashion, not values. However, looking over this particular person's Instagram, I think that would be a better question to directly ask her. But also, if anyone just heard a ding, sorry, my phone turned off, do not disturb. I think it's an interesting one. I think we need to be, especially on social media, we need to be very conscious about what we're posting. I've evaluated things I've posted, and I think we need to really move away from glamorizing and romanticizing the past. I think she may be at fault of presenting a romantic ideal of the past intentionally or unintentionally. And I think that's the issue. I even saw someone bring that up about, you know, when people have 1920s parties, it's like, well, you know, the 1920s was a very bad time for, let's say, people of color, you know? So I think it's important to kind of teeter that line of you're wearing a costume or you're wearing a fun outfit, but you're not glamorizing and romanticizing this past.
I mean, I think it's something that I don't even, I was so interested to bring it up because I don't even really know where I stand on that, to be honest. I genuinely don't know. I'd have to think about it because I love fashion so much. Like I don't look like it right now. I've got to be honest. I'm, you know, it's the evening. It's fine. It will pass. But I really love fashion and I love vintage fashion a lot. And I love going vintage clothes shopping. And my favorite thing. And like my favorite kind of like fashion time period is the 1920s, like New York flappers. Yep. I absolutely love it. I have quite a few things that I've consciously bought because I'm like, oh my God, I look like a flapper right now. This is great.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, okay, am I over analyzing something when I could be redirecting my attention to something that will actually matter a bit more? Do you know what I mean?
No, I do. And I think for like, let's take that example. I think as long as you're saying, I love 1920s fashion and fashion designers, I think that's what matters. I think it's the people that post and are like, oh, or not post, or even just say like, oh, I wish I lived in the 20s. Like, and I'm not saying when I was a lot younger, I'm guilty of that. I'm talking about people our age who, you know, have had the education that we've been blessed enough to have, and that should be beyond that style of thought. You know, I think there's a difference. I think being able to appreciate the fashion of the past and the designers and the creativity, you know, the 20s was really revolutionary when it comes to fashion. There's no shape.
Oh, completely.
It's sexy, it's not skin tight. It's so different.
But that's what makes it sexy.
Yeah, I think, no, it is.
That it's just so, that silhouette is so different. It's loose fitting. I love it. Yeah.
I think my stance would be, as long as you're emphasizing what it is that you like, the styles, the design, and not, like we were saying, romanticizing it and being like, oh, the Great Gatsby movie makes me want to live in the 20s. You know, things like that. I think that's where it crosses into, okay, well, you know, that's maybe not the best thing. Especially, again, you can have whatever thought you want in private, but on social media, we really need to be, especially, like I said, as two educated women, we're very lucky to have learned the things we've learned to hopefully kind of set the tone for others.
Definitely.
I mean, that makes it sound like we're important, but I don't mean it that way.
I think it happens in a very kind of like microcosmic level, because I've learned a lot of my kind of like behavior from things that I see on social media, because we grow up like even people that I follow in my town, or like people that I know have done archaeology before me at the same university, like I'll sit there and I'll be like, okay, let me see what they've done, like, and that can actually have quite a snowball effect. So I really agree with you. I think social media is such a powerful place. I think it's a great place, first of all. I really do, because you know, I wouldn't have met you without it, so that's fantastic. But it also
it's finding
because
the line.
It's powerful. It's finding the line. 100%.
I feel the same way with human remains and social media.
Oh yes.
I go back and forth every year as I develop as a person and as a scholar. I think, in my opinion, and you know, again, this is my opinion, I think posting pictures of teaching collections are okay, because tons of students are seeing them anyway. And I don't think it's the worst thing ever to have a promotional photo of you working with remains that thousands of students are seeing anyway. However, there's a couple accounts I follow that are posting every single grave they're excavating. And I'm like, just don't think that's ethical. Because I know when I did field school, they specifically said, you cannot post pictures of the graves.
I'd expect that. Definitely. I wouldn't be shocked if I heard that either.
So I think it's, you know, I think specifically the accounts I'm talking about are perhaps the person is running the site, so I suppose they set the rules. But I think, especially when we're talking about pictures of graves, aka the bones are still in their final resting place, that's very disrespectful.
I completely agree with you.
Now, is someone at fault for posting that, not understanding, for example, they get excited and it's their first field school and they really want to post a picture? No, I don't think. I think it's a learning process. I think you need to have someone who explains to you why it's disrespectful. But specifically certain accounts on social media, I've kind of recently been like, you know, maybe someone I want to invite on the podcast, and then I'm like, really, you'd be posting pictures of skeletal remains every other day? Like, that's just not the vibe of respect that we're going for. I think,
completely agree with you as
there's a time and place.
Yeah, completely. And I think as well, as you said, there's a difference between posting a picture of human remains that are still intact in the grave that they were originally buried in, and then obviously if it's in a lab and it's like one bone, if it's like a, I can imagine. I feel like we've both had very chaotic days. Like,
I've had a chaotic 2 months.
It's these new beginnings. It really is. New beginnings, postgraduate life.
Yeah. On that note, what are you most looking forward to at UCL, or just living in London in general?
So as much as like I feel like I always have to give a disclaimer about when I talk about the British Museum, because there are problems with the British Museum. Saying that, I am really excited to be close to that place and to work in its collections, because it really does have such a fantastic collection. Also, I'm excited to be around the academics that work in the British Museum, because that would be, you know, you said the Smithsonian is like your dream place to work, yeah. right? Mine's the British Museum. So I feel lucky to be that close to it. And a lot of the like course material is held at the institution. And also we have like guest lecturers from the British Museum as well. Mm-hmm. So that's definitely like one of the biggest things I'm looking forward to. Also, I'm looking forward to formally studying archaeology, because I actually haven't really done that before. I've just done art history, which I took. So my modules were so far removed from like what I'm now interested in. So my final year, I took my first module in digitally, it was amazing though, digitally reconstructing Renaissance Florence. And it was fantastic. It was led by Dr. Donald Cooper. He works like in tangent with the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. They did a whole exhibition about it, where they also invited like David Hockney to come and contribute, and it was brilliant. And then I also took a course on the art of the Islamic world from the Prophet to 1500s by Dr. Vivek Gupta. He is absolutely amazing. He where did he teach before? I want to say Stanford, but I feel like that's wrong. But he's a great academic. And that was actually, that course is what really got me thinking about like global links and trade links and migration. There's also a really fantastic article that I think you would like. It's about 13th century Sicily. So it's very kind of removed, but the methodology of it is fantastic. It's called Pathways of Portability, and it's by Eva Hoffman. And what it does is it takes this one object. It's a royal mantle that belonged to Roger II of Sicily in the 13th century. And it has connections to like the Islamic world. It has connections to Italy. It has connections to France. And pretty much what she says is that there is no fixed meaning in one object, and meaning changes like when an object travels. Every new hand that an object falls in, the meaning will change. So you can't assign one meaning to an object. And that just like revolutionized my way of thinking about material culture. And so it kind of was very formative. But yeah, I'm excited to apply that to archaeology at UCL. Awesome. To go back to your question. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's so exciting. I'm excited for, you know, your new journey. I get to talk to so many people that are kind of in the same stage of their career as I am. It's, you know, it's a time, something that we were talking about beforehand that I'm just going to say to everyone, because I feel like it's relevant. Don't set too high of expectations for yourself, because transitions are transitions. And, you know, whatever the adjustment may be, even if it's not school, maybe you've adjusted to school just fine. Living in a new place, living with roommates, really anything, you know, give yourself the grace for that adjustment period, because I struggle with that. I'm getting better at it. I've already had quite a bit better of a week than my first week.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. I just think we need to be, give ourselves grace and time, because
empathy as well.
Empathy. Yeah. Transitions, they don't happen in the snap of a finger. Just because you move somewhere doesn't mean it's an instant click. Even if it is an instant click, it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. You'll have car troubles like me.
I completely agree with you, because I think like a lot of change, and this sounds the exact same for you, I'm sure you agree, but a lot of change has occurred around like me starting or beginning to start the postgraduate degree. So like moving city, having to deal with like private rent, which I didn't have to do at university, and having to deal with bills and stuff like that, having to get a new part-time job, and then meeting new people, and just a very different kind of lifestyle. And I think to be completely like real with you, what happened is that I found myself getting a lot more stressed about like very simple things, and I couldn't understand why. And I was like, why is this getting on my nerves? Like, usually I wouldn't feel stressed about something like this. And it's because there's so much upheaval that's going on around me that I have this like tendency to want to control things and micromanage things because everything's changing around you, right?
I feel that.
Yes. And I think it's so common. I mean, me and my housemate talk about it all the time because we're literally the same person. It's very nice. But yeah, I think when there's change going on around you, you will have the desire to absolutely like control everything in your life. And when things don't go wrong, it can be, don't go right. It can be really like painful and confusing and discombobulating. But what I've learned is it's just the human response to change.
Yeah, it is. I think that's a great note to end on. Thank you so much for talking with me. And for the listeners, it's quite late where Tara is. So I want to say a big thank you to you for making this work. Between our two schedules, it can be hard to, you know, find a time, but it was lovely to chat with you.
No, thank you so much for having me on. Like, I'm really, really excited to be here because, as you mentioned at the start, I listened to the podcast and it feels great to be on it. Really exciting. And yeah, this is not that late. It's fine. But this was completely worth it anyway. So thank you so much. Really enjoyed talking.